You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. For federal wildlife enforcement officers, time on the job means a lot of time alone, wandering remote areas. But one wildlife officer now has a new companion to keep him company on the trails, the Pacific Region's very first enforcement dog. Courtney Flatt has more about this pair.
The first thing you might notice about Uki, the newest enforcement dog for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is that he speaks Dutch.
His name is actually Dutch slang for little one. He's a little bit on the smaller side of a Belgian Malinois.
Officer Josh Heinemann looks down at the light brown dog lying at his feet. Uki looks very much like a German Shepherd. Uki was bred and born in Holland, which means Heinemann had to learn a few tricks of his own. Commands in Dutch.
Or my version. A Dutch person might not agree with me, but it's Dutch.
One command.
Abort.
Uki takes off searching scraggly bushes behind a barn in Burbank, Washington. He's looking for my phone, trying to pick up fresh human scent in the air. It's like a training mission for the sort of search he might do in the backcountry. Uki zigzags through the bushes.
And I kind of keep him on target.
The two are new to this. They've been working in the field for about a month. But already, Heinemann sees Uki's benefit to his work, looking for poachers, drug users, lost hikers, in remote areas in the Pacific Northwest, and as far afield as Nevada and the Pacific Islands, all with little to no backup in sight.
He's my partner. He's adding another law enforcement officer to ride with me. So our station has got three law enforcement officers. Essentially, it's got four now because I have a partner that can protect me, that can pull his own weight and do his own thing.
Uki is the 13th dog to join the force nationally. And they're a welcome addition.
Suspects get away from us. We just couldn't find them in a tree farm or something like that, and it would have been nice to have the dog to find them.
It's important to keep those sniffing and tracking skills up. The two train with other enforcement dogs in the area, like Benton County and the State Department of Fish and Wildlife.
The dog loves coming to work. He gets excited when we get in the truck. He gets excited on training days. Even when he's doing the control work and you know, I've sent him to bite the bad guy, so to speak. He's not fighting that guy. It's a play.
And that's evident when Uki searches the bushes for my phone. He shakes with excitement, not cold. He passes by a Coke can and a piece of litter that had blown in from a nearby road. He could tell those objects hadn't been near people recently. And after a few minutes of sniffing, he finds my blue cell phone case hidden in the bushes.
There he goes. See, he downed, and he's looking at the thing.
The job's complete, and it's time for a little reward. Heinemann grabs a white ball out of his pocket. It's attached to a piece of rope.
Yeah, that's a good boy. Oh, that's a good boy, yeah.
See, his tail's wagging. He's having a blast.
Uki grabs the ball, and Heinemann pulls the rope. Oh. He lifts Uki a couple feet in the air. The pair swing around in a circle. Heinemann says this partnership could last for 10 years.
First in the region, so I got a lot of eyes on me.
But he says they can handle that. I'm Courtney Flatt in Burbank, Washington.
Oh, that's a good dog.
Yeah.
That's a good dog.
Early this year, piles of deep snow drifted into Burns, Oregon, and then so did the outsiders and their money. Gas stations, cafes, and hotels are seeing packed crowds in a normally sleepy wintertime. For businesses, the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge occupation is a boom. Correspondent Anna King has more.
After Christmas in Burns, some local businesses just shutter for months until spring. Others, like the America's Best Value Inn, usually lay off most of their staff.
I haven't had a day off since New Year's Day, and normally I have 4 days off.
Maid Liz Hauer says she usually doesn't have enough work this time of year to keep on.
Is that good or bad?
It's good for me right now.
Money.
Yeah, because usually I'm on unemployment about this time.
Plunked right off of US 20, the hotel's manager, Vicki Allen, says she's never seen a winter like this. 38 rooms, nearly full up every night.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes we might only have one person in the house in the winter months. So this is, it's a godsend. It's like having summer all winter long.
But she admits it's sometimes a strange mix at the Continental Breakfast Bar each morning. law enforcement and occupiers wrangling over the coffee urn and Danish.
The police don't bother anybody. The militia don't bother anybody. We only get maybe two or three militia in here a week. They come to clean up and go back out.
Everyone has been well behaved, she says.
They just don't talk over the differences between them, you know.
Of the half dozen hotels I visited in Burns, most are selling triple or double the rooms they usually would this time of year. A bit northeast in town, on North Broadway, Bella Java and Bistro is waking up. Regulars, like a table full of ball cap wearing Burns veterans, swamp in for coffee. Strangers, too, like a posse of Oregonian writers. Manager Tammy Delane is working overtime in the back. Today she was making lunchtime beef wraps for the 10 or so law enforcement officers protecting the town's elementary school.
I wish it was different circumstances, but we do love it. It's helping the businesses as far as restaurants and stuff.
She says she's had the occupiers in too. They've been polite, but the sheer volume of business hasn't let up.
Oh my gosh. It starts at 7:30 and coffee's breakfast, trying to do prep. Like I say, we're catering right now. Lunches are overwhelming and they're still here at 3.
Still, many business owners say they are purposefully laying low. At a remote cafe and convenience store outside of Burns, the manager there says she's had threatening emails from some supporting the occupiers. And then old-time customers who come to birdwatch at Malheur call to chew her out. She was afraid to give me her name. She says staying neutral is tough business these days. One quiet surprise in Burns business news. Traffic at the B&B Sporting Goods store has been just a tick over average. B&B owner Denny Thomas sells about any make of gun, ammo, or knife one could want in Harney County. Or he'll order it in.
We have high-end shotguns back there, higher-end shotguns. And rifles. These are our semi-automatic handguns.
On average, he sells about four guns a day. Last week, he said, that skipped up to five a day. But he says no occupiers are coming in for bulk buys.
We still have predominantly local shoppers. We get a few people coming in because they might need a pair of gloves. But other than that, things are pretty normal.
The hot seller this week, shotgun shells to ranchers. There's a rabbit population boom this winter. People are blasting them to keep the hungry bunnies off their haystacks. I'm Anna King in Burns, Oregon.
The deadline for Washington lawmakers to fully fund public schools and take the pressure off local levies is just 2 years away. Their failure to come up with a plan to accomplish that goal has resulted in a $100,000 a day Supreme Court sanction. Lawmakers returned to the Capitol on Monday for a short election year session. They say getting bipartisan agreement on a school funding plan is a top priority. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports.
Republican State Senator Ann Rivers says, think of it this way. If last legislative session was about pot.
This year, pot and transportation, which don't go hand in hand.
This year, she says, is about education.
And it has reached a fever pitch. It's top of mind for all of the legislature.
Rivers has been part of a bipartisan, bicameral group that's been meeting all fall at the behest of Democratic Governor Jay Inslee. They've been trying to come up with a plan that can pass a divided legislature, a plan that commits the legislature to end the reliance on local school levies to fund public schools by the 2017-18 school year. Democratic State Senator Christine Rolfes says it hasn't been easy, especially in a legislature where Democrats control one chamber and Republicans the other.
We are an absolutely split legislative body right now. So what we put forward has to necessarily reflect conservative values as well as progressive values. And it's very, very difficult to move something forward that's this big.
Translation? Don't expect a big, comprehensive plan this year. In fact, don't even expect a plan that will necessarily get the Washington legislature out of contempt of court. Here's House Majority Leader Pat Sullivan, a Democrat.
You know, our goal wasn't necessary to satisfy the court. Our goal was to figure out a pathway forward to solving the problem.
That means the big thorny questions will wait until next year. Questions like, where will the money come from? Should there be a levy swap? Should teachers have to bargain at a statewide level instead of locally? Sullivan acknowledges time is running short.
And it is taking more time than I would like, and I think probably any of us would like. But the fact is that there is more work that needs to be done.
In recent years, the legislature has pumped an additional $2.3 billion into public schools to address transportation and operating costs, expand full-day kindergarten, and reduce K-3 class sizes. But lawmakers have left the most complicated issue for last. How to shift the burden of compensating teachers and staff from local levies back onto the state. The cost to do this has been pegged at $3 to $4 billion more per two-year budget cycle. Republican State Representative Chad Magendanz is also part of the group that's been meeting to hash this stuff out. He says what happens this legislative session will set the course for a heavy lift next year.
2017 is going to be a tough year for us as we negotiate every element of what needs to be part of this plan to fund the commitment that we're stating in this legislation during the 2016 legislative session.
The lawmakers all spoke at a legislative preview hosted by the Associated Press. All this talk of a plan conjures the hospital bed scene in the Batman movie, The Dark Knight.
Do I really look like a guy with a plan?
Cue the Joker.
The mob has plans. The cops have plans. Gordon's got plans.
And soon the legislature says it will have a plan. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Still ahead, Oregon has a problem when it comes to high school graduation rates. Dylan Bille explains part of his path to dropping out.
We would always hang out, then we'd start skipping class. It was like, I'm behind in my class, so why should I go? I don't feel like I could get caught up in time to be able to pass, so what's the point in going?
Jacob Lewin reports on how Corvallis High School has improved the graduation rate there. That story coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Mostly cloudy today. Chance of rain this morning and afternoon. Highs in the mid-40s. Then more rain this evening. Showers likely after midnight. Overnight lows tonight around 40. Coast Community Radio meteorologist Gordon McCraw says more rain is in the forecast for tomorrow morning. Showers tomorrow afternoon. Then a short break before more rain late Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Martin Luther King Day on Monday. Highs continue in the high 40s and low 50s. Overnight lows in the high 30s and low 40s. Keep those raincoats handy. More than one in four of Oregon's high school students don't graduate, or at least don't graduate on time. The U.S. Department of Education ranks the state 47th, although that is up from 49th a year ago. This morning, we'll hear why the rate is so low and what a school in Corvallis is doing to help change that.
Good morning, CHS. This is Avery Allen with your morning announcements.
Here at Corvallis High School, you'll find kids like Dylan Bille. Dylan struggled when he got here as a freshman. In middle school, he had no social life and was sick a lot, so making friends became a priority.
We would always hang out, then we'd start skipping class. It was like, I'm behind in my class, so why should I go? I don't feel like I could get caught up in time to be able to pass, so what's the point in going?
A study by the Chalkboard Project shows one quarter of Oregon students are chronically absent, and even more don't graduate from high school in 4 years.
It is stunning to us to see the correlation with missing 10 days or more and the impact on the high school completion.
The Chalkboard Project's Dan Jameson. John Taponia, president of Echo Northwest, a consulting firm, sees a cultural connection between the high absenteeism rate and the low graduation rate. He says Oregon may not have what he calls a culture of completion.
We are in the West. It is sort of a live and let live environment.
If Oregon were a person, it would be a type B, not a type A. States like Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana have higher graduation rates. Yet Taponia thinks Oregon offers a better education than those states.
The achievement scores that we see, for example, on national tests in eighth grade, where Oregon really is just solidly average. If you had to pick the average of average states, and yet follow those same kids 4 years into the future, you see us fall way to the bottom. There's just a real disconnect there.
When he took over at Corvallis High School, which has a relatively high number of disadvantaged kids, Principal Matt Boring brought a personal perspective to bear.
I have a unique situation as a father. My daughter, Emily, is a sophomore at Yale University, and my son Aaron is in the life skills program here at Corvallis High School, a junior. You know, you have an Ivy Leaguer and a kid who can't read or write.
When he got here 5 years ago, Boring was appalled at the school's 70% graduation rate. He focused on the kids who were struggling, partly by changing the schedules of his teachers.
Putting the most passionate teachers in front of those kids, educating not just the easy kids, the kids who come to school ready.
Trying not to shortchange the more successful students, Boring makes sure his best teachers take on advanced placement classes as well as the neediest kids. He also personally nabs underachievers in the hall all the time.
Hey, Gordon.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your 24% in American Lit.
Uh-huh.
How'd you get it so low?
I got kind of behind. There's some stuff going on, you know, outside.
Oregon's unique Latino situation also impacts our graduation rate. A high percentage of Oregon Latinos arrived here in the 90s, mostly farm workers with little education and little English. Their kids are now high school-aged. Kids whose parents are poor and relatively uneducated are more likely to have problems in school. As with other districts, Corvallis has pressed hard to expand its English language learners program.
Okay. Entonces, ¿qué es lo que tiene Lucho de la novela?
Partly due to ELL and acculturation,
sí, gracias, Julissa.
The Latino graduation rate has improved significantly, and that's expected to continue. But that will hardly solve all of our problems. Dan Jameson of Chalkboard says the low graduation rate cuts across all demographics.
We have the poorest high school completion for white students probably in the nation.
But Dylan Bie and his friends probably will graduate. One of those teachers, who now see a range of students, showed confidence and lit a fire under them.
We stayed every day after school tutoring, and I was like, dang, I can do this. I know I can graduate.
Corvallis High has gone from that 70% graduation rate to better than 85%. In Portland, I'm Jacob Lewin.
The armed militants who continue to occupy the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County represent a fringe group expressing strong anti-federal sentiment. But this animosity toward the federal government is nothing new in the West. Leaders of the Sagebrush Rebellion of the 1970s and 80s demanded more state control of public lands. And more recent attempts to transfer federal land continue today. Reporter Frankie Barnhill talked with Boise State public lands expert John Freemuth about anti-government tension. Freemuth says it dates back to the creation of the first national forests and parks.
But most of the tension has been understandable and healthy. I mean, who decides these issues? People closest to it or the entire country? And what do we use these lands for? Do we use them to produce jobs and goods and services for us? You know, cattle grazing, mining, logging, or are they as much for environmental value protection, clean water, open space, you know, wilderness, all of that sort of business? I think at times the federal land agencies have had people who, most of them are from the West, many of them go to Western land grant universities, but they're trained as sort of subject matter experts, and they're out there because they like to work with things, wildlife, you know, the range cons, but work with people? No. I mean, I like being outside. And so as these issues have become all value-laden with all sorts of people's points of view, then for a time they didn't maybe have those skills, but I think the agencies have very much realized that they need people who have good communications and can work with people. But I think it's more the other stuff, the different approaches to what we want from those lands and who decides the questions.
Take us back to the Sagebrush Rebellion. Give us a little refresher.
Yeah, and this is another thing most people don't understand is that was not the first Sagebrush Rebellion. I actually have you can show you that at the turn of the last century when there was no BLM, the Forest Service sought and received both regulatory authority and the courts backed them to regulate grazing. I can find you people back then who were demanding the forest be transferred to the states. So you know, they weren't up in arms about it, but there were movements. The Sagebrush Rebellion is primarily about the BLM land, because Congress passed a law in 76 called the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, which more or less stated as federal policy that that land would remain under federal management, not every acre certainly. Some people in the West thought those lands would be disposed of. Well, one way to dispose of them is to say they will remain under federal management, and they did, and that set off that Sagebrush Rebellion of the mid-70s.
So is what's happening in Eastern Oregon right now the 2016 version of the Sagebrush Rebellion, or is this a new iteration?
You know, totally different? I don't – what I find interesting about this one, and it could be how much the agencies have tried to do better. There has been effective work on sage grouse to avoid a listing, and some relationships were built. What has intrigued me about this is the true locals' response out there in Burns is, Bundy's not from here. We didn't understand why our friends here, our two ranchers, have to go back to jail, and we wanted to have a little protest about that. But Bundy, get out of here with the guns and the flags and the craziness. You're not from here either. So that's the most interesting part, is the locals there appear to want nothing to do with this crazy business.
How do you think this is going to play out? What's next?
Well, it's going to play out either somebody's going to get trigger happy and we're going to have a horrible event, or hopefully the local sheriff and others can defuse it, find a face-saving way to get them to retreat. But it's not over. They're looking for this small element. The way I think you defeat it is that you get thoughtful policy changes. Governor Otter, for example, is sponsoring a Western Governor's meeting here in a couple of weeks on Endangered Species Act reform, and I'm helping with that. But anyway, I think it's going to be a balanced approach to, you know, what can we change about the law that would make sense? What can't we? And you get enough people willing to support those battles within those boundaries. So the Bundys are so marginalized, they have no support, and eventually they go away.
So could something like this happen in Idaho?
Sure. One of the ringleaders of this whole movement is based in Idaho. They tried to do it with recreational dredge mining up north. There was going to be a big protest, but BLM was able to handle that fairly well with state folks, and it kind of never led to anything. But clearly, it could happen here. Not from our ranchers. I know a lot of them. I can't see that they want to touch anything that has to do with violence. But certainly it could happen here. We had Ruby Ridge. We've had events in Idaho.
And that was a conversation between Boise State public lands expert John Freemuth and reporter Frankie Barnhill. And that is all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.